This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
The topic of our tragedy for tonight is David and Michal, no love story. But before we get into the Michal story, I would like to say some general words about David and his wives. As you can see, reading the text, reading the handout, David had many of them, many wives. We can assume it from the list of his sons in 2 Samuel chapter 3. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam of Jezreel. His second was Kilav by Abigail, wife of Nabal the Carmelite. The third was Absalom, son of Maacha, daughter of King Talmai of Geshur. The fourth was Adoniah, son of Haggid. The fifth was Shephatiah, son of Avital. And the sixth was Yitream by David's wife, Eglah. These were born to David in Hebron. But that's not the whole story, because if you look at the second text here from 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 13, after he left Hebron, when he became king all over Israel, not just king of Judah in Hebron, so David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to David. Of course, his harem was not as big as his sons. Solomon had 1,000 wives. I don't know exactly what was the number of David's wives, but he had a large enough harem, I would say. But anyway, the Bible cannot tell us the story of all his wives and children. I've already mentioned it, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago. No, last week I did not mention anything because I was not here. But 2 weeks ago, I believe I said that when it comes to David's sons, although we had many of them, we had stories only about four. About Amnon, who did what he did with his half-sister Tamar, and then about Absalom, who rebelled against his father. Then Adoniah, who had the ambition of becoming the king. And then, of course, the fourth one was Solomon, who became the king. The same is true for David's wives. We see he had many of them, but we have stories only about four. We have the story about Michal. We have the story in 1 Samuel chapter 25 about Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And then we have the story of Bathsheba, of course, who was the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And then at the very end, actually at the very beginning of the book of Kings, we have the story about Abishag the Shunammite, who has not been actually David's wife. The king did not know her. And this very last episode, at the very beginning of the book of Kings, tells you how tragic David's life was. Because when he is old and fragile, and he is cold, lying there in his bed, neither a wife nor a son, nobody comes to visit. His servants have to take care of him. It's his servants that come up with the brilliant idea of bringing some young lady, some beautiful lady, to be with him. And actually, it's another Cinderella story. They look through all Israel for the most beautiful girl and bring her to David to keep him warm in the winter. But the king did not know her. And that's the end of the tragedy of David's life. David, who was such a successful leader, who gave us Jerusalem, who conquered for us half of the Middle East, and yet, when it came to his family, it was not a great success. And if we go over the list of wives about whom we have stories, so all of them were married to other men. If they are good for other men, they're also good for me. Michal was originally David's wife, but then she is being given to somebody else. And then David, when he becomes a king, he demands her back. And Abigail was the wife of Nabal the Carmelite in the Judean desert. And David, by marrying her shows that he is the strong man in the area. Same thing, I guess, with Bathsheba. When Uriah the Hittite is dead, David now takes his wife and shows that he is a strong man in Jerusalem. So David, we see, did not love his wives. At least it's never written that David loved any wife of his. Yeah, and that's perhaps the beginning and the end of the tragedy. He did not love them. All of them were instrumental for him to become a strong man, a leader, a king. But as we said, no love story. Now, when we start reading the story about Michal, actually, first we read about Meirav, Saul's eldest daughter. In 1 Samuel chapter 14, we have a list of Saul's children. Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malkishua. And the names of his two daughters were Merav the older and Michal the younger. And then in 1 Samuel chapter 18, from verse 17 on, 1 Samuel chapter 18, by the way, at the beginning of the chapter, we still hear about the relationship between David and Jonathan. It's actually the end of the David and Goliath story. We hear about the women praising David, Hika Shaul Ba'alafav and David Berivotav, Saul becoming jealous of David. And that leads us to the episode about which we are going to read now. Verse 17 in 1 Samuel 18, Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter Merav. I'll give her to you in marriage. In return, you be my warrior and fight the battles of the Lord." Saul thought, actually in Hebrew he said, you know, in the Bible we don't think, we say. Yeah, but what can I do? Yeah, but in translation it's always being translated here as to think. Saul thought, "Let not my hand strike him, let the hand of the Philistine strike him." David replied to Saul, "Who am I and what is my life, my father's family in Israel, that I should become your majesty's son-in-law?" It's quite similar to what, for instance, Gideon is saying when the angel tells him that he is the one to save Israel. And he says, "Please, my Lord, how can I deliver Israel? Why? My clan is the humblest in Manasseh, and I'm the youngest in my father's household." Anyway, so he is very humble. David is very humble, but all of a sudden, in verse 19, we read, "But at the time that Merav, daughter of Saul, should have been given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel the Meholatite." We don't know why, we don't know how, nothing. It may remind you in some ways, you know, a little of the story of Jacob, that's about the confusion that took place there. He thought he was going to be married to one, and then he finds in his bed the other one. And actually, even more similar to the story of Samson. If you remember the story of Samson, if you don't, read it tonight. When Samson, you know that Samson was into Philistine women. That was his shtick. Yeah, so he insists on marrying a Philistine woman. He marries her, but during the wedding ceremony, or actually during the Sheva Bruches, he comes up with the riddle, and the Philistines cannot solve the riddle, and they tempt his wife, actually force his wife to tempt him to reveal his secret. And when he realizes that she has cheated him, he gets very angry, goes away. When he comes down, he comes back too late, because her father has given her already to somebody else. So we don't know what happened here. But what I do know, that the three verses from verse 17 to verse 19 are not in the Septuagint. again, as if it. I'll show you later. I think that it has been added in a secondary stage, very similar to what we have seen 2 weeks ago in the David and Goliath story, that some insertion were brought into the text from parallel traditions, etc. So the whole episode about David marrying Michal is not in the Septuagint. And Mirav, I just wanted to see if you are still awake. Okay, fine. Anyway, I started quoting here from verse 17. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter." But if I go back to verse 16 in chapter 18 says, "All Israel and Judah loved David, for he marched at their lead." All of them loved David. And if I skip verses 17 to 19, from verse 16 directly to verse 20, in verse 20, now Michal, daughter of Saul, had fallen in love with David. So all Israel and Judah loved David, and now also Michal, the daughter of Saul, loves David. And that's, again, the big tragedy. She loves him, but as we have already said, he does not necessarily love her. So she was falling in love with David, and when it was reported to Saul, he was pleased. Well, when you read this verse for the first time, you can think that he's pleased. Wow, young David, such a talented guy, such a great warrior, the guy who killed Goliath, I'll be happy to give her to him. But no, he was pleased for a very different reason. Saul thought, again, he said in Hebrew, Saul thought, "I will give her to him, and she can serve as a snare for him so that the Philistines may kill him." And you see that this episode about Michal is very similar to the one about Merav. Actually, we have here two parallel stories, actually two duplications of the following the same contents. A daughter of Saul is about to be given to David. Saul is very happy with the idea because that's a way to get rid of David, etc., etc. But now look at verse 21. The end of verse 21, the second half, which I have not read yet. "So Saul said to David, 'You can become my son-in-law even now through the second one.'" Translators are liars. That's not what's written in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it's written, "Bishtaim titchaten bihayom." Through two, you'll become my son-in-law today. But the translators wanted the text to be smooth, so they changed it. It's so irresponsible. I protest. Anyway, and again, this second half of the verse is not in the Septuagint. So in the Septuagint, we read that "I'll give her to him and she can serve as a snare for him so that the Philistines may kill him." And we continue with verse 22. "And Saul instructed his courtiers to say to David privately, 'The king is fond of you, and all his courtiers like you or love you.'" It's the same root all the time, ahov, ahov, ahov. "So why not become the king's son-in-law?" When the king's courtiers repeated these words to David, David replied. This time he gave it a second thought. He's not as humble as he was the first time. Now he's ready for the adventure. So David replied, "Do you think that becoming the son-in-law of the king is small matter when I'm but a poor man of no consequence?" Saul's courtiers reported to him. This is what David answered. And Saul said, "Say this to David, 'The king desires no other bright prize than the foreskins of 100 Philistines as vengeance on the king's enemy.'" Just think how original, how original. Yeah. But of course, Saul intended to bring about David's death at the hands of the Philistines. But when the courtiers told it to David, David was pleased. No problem for him. He was so pleased with the idea of becoming the king's son-in-law. And here you see the tragedy. She loved him, and for him, it was like a springboard to become the king's son-in-law. Awful. Before the time had expired, I guess he was given like a week or two to do the mission. And before the time had expired, David went out with his men and killed 200 Philistines. David brought their foreskins. Think about it. Think about the picture. About the bag of foreskins he brought with him. And now think about them counting them. I see like a committee in the ballot, you know, counting the votes after the elections. Yeah, very funny. So David went out with his men and killed. But look, here it's written that he killed 200 Philistines. He was asked to bring 100. So either you'll say that he wanted to show that he's even much better than what was expected of him. But actually, again, in the Septuagint, he killed 100, not 200 men. So again, this 200 is still another remnant of this tradition that he married the two daughters of Saul and not just one of them. So David brought the foreskins and they were counted out for the king that he might become the king's son-in-law. Saul then gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. The poor guy had no choice but to give him to David. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that Michal, daughter of Saul, and pay attention to the fact that Michal is being referred to here as Michal, daughter of Saul. She is still the daughter of her father. Later on, we'll see that he will be referred to differently. Daughter of Saul loved him. Saul grew still more afraid of David, and Saul was David's enemy ever after. Oyev. If you remember, at the very end of chapter 16, he loved David. He was Ohev. And now, after we heard that everybody else loved David, Michal loved David, Jonathan loved David, the king's servant loved David, all Israel and Judah loved David, but now Saul, who's so very jealous, became from Ohev, he became an Oyev of David. Yeah. And don't forget what I told you again like 3 weeks ago when we mentioned the fact that the name David is related to the word Dod, the beloved one. And all these verses about people loving David is sort of a name etymology, a name derivation, an explanation of the name David, Dod, the beloved, the one whom everybody else loves. Fine. Now we can go on to chapter 19. Story continues there. Saul, who's so very jealous of David, now he looks for a way to kill David. Saul sent messengers to David's home to keep watch on him and to kill him in the morning. But David's wife Michal told him. Now you see how she is being referred to. She is not Saul's daughter anymore. She is David's wife, Michal. So the narrator, this way the narrator tells you where her heart is. Her heart is with David and not with her father. She's loyal to her husband, not to her father anymore. But David's wife, Michal, told him, unless you run for your life tonight, you will be killed tomorrow. Michal let David down from the window, and he escaped and fled. Well, think about women in windows. It's a very... I'm not talking about Amsterdam, I'm sorry. No. The moment I mention women in plural in windows, no. But think about the Bible. Think about this motif in the Bible. Who else is Rahab, the lady from Jericho, which again you see the quotation from Joshua chapter 2, verse 15. She let them, the spies, the two agents of the Israeli Mossad, She let them down by the rope through the window, for her dwelling was at the outer side of the city wall, and she lived in the actual wall. So Michal, again, the story about Rahab, very similar to the episode of Michal, because this way, by letting the spies through the window, she saved their lives, of course. But who else is in the window? Sisra's mother, yeah, in Shirat Devorah, in the poem of Deborah, again, Sisra, like a royal lady, standing up there at the window, looking down, expecting her son to return. Jezebel. And Jezebel, exactly. Jezebel in the Book of Kings, same thing. Yehu, the usurpator, is about to enter the city of Jezreel, and she knows he's coming. She knows her son is already dead, that he has already killed her son, Jehoram. And she knows she's going to be killed momentarily, and yet she stands there as a real queen. Yeah, very. But you know that also, not only in biblical narratives or in biblical poetry, but also in the plastic arts of that period, we have this image of the woman in the window in little plates of ivory that, for instance, from the palace of Ahab in Jezreel, we found these little images of women in the window, also in Cyprus, in Babel, all over the area. We have this image of the woman in the window. So anyway, Michal lets David down through the window. We don't know if she did it with a rope or he jumped down. I don't know. Here it's not mentioned. But anyway, and that's another common motif of the Bible, women who help men to escape. Sometimes they help adults to escape. Sometimes they help little boys to escape. For instance, a story about Moshe, of course, when his mother hides him for 3 months, or the story about King Jehoash at the very at 2 Kings chapter 10, the story about Jehoash, Ataliah, the wicked lady, kills all the all the princes of the house of David, and just one of them is being saved by his aunt, who is Jehoash, who later become the king. So, and also we have a very similar story to the Rahab story in 2 Samuel chapter 17, the story of the two spies that David sends to the camp of Absalom. And again, when they are discovered by the enemies, a woman there in Bahurim hides them until she can send them back safely back to David. So Michal is very helpful. She helps David to escape. Now we read verse 13. Michal then took the household idol, which are the teraphim. Yeah, here it's translated as the household idol. laid it on the bed, so you can imagine that this household idol looked like a human being, and covered it with a cloth. And at his head she put a net of goat's hair. Fine. Saul sends messenger to seize David, but she said, he's sick. Saul, however, sent back his messengers to see David for themselves. Bring him up to me in the bed, he ordered, that he may be put to death. When the messengers came, they found the household idol in the bed with a net of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, why did you play that trick on me and let my enemy get away safely? Because, Michal, answered Saul, he said to me, help me get away or I'll kill you. That was her way to explain it to her father without endangering her own life. But now pay attention to the fact that we have a story here about a woman using household idols, teraphim, to cheat her father. And that brings us back to the next text you have here, Text number 7, the story of Rachel and the teraphim. And there is a great resemblance between the two stories, the story of Rachel and the teraphim and Michal and the teraphim. I will not read the whole story of Rachel, but here and there I'll read a couple of verses. Meanwhile, Laban, after Jacob realizes it's time to leave Laban, and he, with his wives and his whole household, they escape from the house of Laban, and Laban chases them. Meanwhile, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household idols. Jacob kept Laban the Aramean in the dark. What a funny translation. Okay, because they didn't want to be literal, but the Hebrew text is Vaignov da Yaakov et lev Laban ha'arami. He stole his heart. That's the expression for cheating. Very nice. So both of them actually stole something. Hers was a real theft. She stole the teraphim, while he just stole the heart of Laban, meaning didn't tell him the whole truth, just escaped. So who's the real thief? Rachel is the real thief, and not David. Okay? Not telling him that he was... and fled with all that he had, etc., etc. I can read a little more from verse 28, 26, for instance. And Laban said to Jacob, after Laban chases Jacob and they meet, so Laban said to David, to Jacob, what did you mean by keeping me in the dark and carrying off my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee in secrecy and misled me and not tell me, etc., etc.? Later on, of course, Laban is searching for the idols, but verse 32, for instance, but anyway, and Jacob, who doesn't know that Rachel stole the teraphim, he's so very innocent, our ancestor Jacob, so he doesn't know anything, and he says to Laban, but anyone with whom you find your God shall not remain alive in the presence of our kinsmen. Point out what I have of yours and take it. Jacob, of course, did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And, of course, Laban keeps searching. He does not find it at the teraphim. And you know the sad end of the story. Jacob says, as if he prophesies, by saying that anyone with whom you find your God shall not remain alive. And actually, before the journey to the land of Canaan is over, Rachel will die. Anyway, you can see the resemblance between these two stories. A daughter cheats her father, uses teraphim for the cheating. Rachel is the mother of Benjamin. And Michal is, of course, from the tribe of Benjamin. So stories about stealing idols, teraphim, are all in the family, the tribe of Benjamin. And more resemblances, both sons-in-law, Jacob and David, at the beginning, they were the favorites of their fathers-in-law, not for a long time. Both sons-in-law have to escape. Jacob escapes. And David escapes. And the teraphim make the flight possible. What are teraphim? If I have to define teraphim today, I think that the best way to define them is Waze. Are you using Waze? Waze. Yeah. Because, yeah, exactly. I was actually disappointed when they called them Waze. They should have called them teraphim. Look at the text number 8 from Ezekiel chapter 21 here. For the king of Babylon has stood at the fork of the road where two roads branch off to perform divination. He has shaken arrows, consulted teraphim, and inspected the liver. So he didn't have ways, actually. But So you see, the teraphim are being used for divination. So now, and the same thing, if you look at Zechariah, the next text from Zechariah chapter 10. For the teraphim spoke delusion, the ogres predicted falsely, and dreamers speak lies and console with illusions. That's why my people have strayed like a flock. They suffer for lack of a shepherd, etc., etc. So again, teraphim are used for divination. And the reason, now you understand why Rachel stole the teraphim. Rashi's answer is very nice. She didn't want her father to worship idols. Yeah, but that's a little too naive for me. And of course, she stole them because she realized that if he has the teraphim, he'll find where they are and he'll follow them. Yeah, so anyway, again, if we still compare these two stories, one to the other, you know, I might have already told you that whenever you find resemblances between two texts in the Bible, look for the differences. The differences are always much more important than the similarities. And here in the story of Rachel pretends to be ill. She pretends to have her period. And in our story, in the David story, David is the one who pretends to be sick, or at least Michal tells her father that David was sick. Rachel's theft or fraud is never discovered. Her father does not find the teraphim, while the fraud of Michal is discovered by her father. Rachel, as we have already said, will die when she has her second son. Michal will not die, but she'll never have any son, according to chapter 6, which we will read very soon. So now David was let down through the window, and he's on his way, and he'll keep marrying wives. Marrying wives, starting his collection of wives. And poor Michal is left home, but her father now is going to give her to somebody else. At the end of the story of Abigail, of chapter 25, we read that now David has taken Abinoam of Jezreel, so both of them became his wives. Saul had given his daughter Michal, David's wife, to Palti, son of Laish from Galim. And now we get to the next episode. And the next episode, after King Saul has died, and his son Ish-bosheth is now a king of a small kingdom, and his uncle, or actually Saul's uncle, Avner, son of Ner, who was Saul's general, or minister of defense, if you want, now is being suspected by Ish-bosheth that he desires Saul's concubine, Rizpah, daughter of Ayah. Who knows, perhaps Ish-bosheth was right. You know that the best way to show that you have a claim to the throne is by taking the harem of the previous king. So perhaps Abner did have the aspiration of becoming the king. But anyway, when he's being blamed by Ish-bosheth, he gets very angry with him, and then he's ready to leave Ish-bosheth and to join David. And that's what we read here. Abner immediately sent messengers to David saying, "To whom shall the land belong?" And to say further, "Make a pact with me and I'll help you and bring all Israel over to your side." He replied, "Good, I'll make a pact with you. But I make one demand upon you. Do not appear before me unless you bring Michal, daughter of Saul." And here she's being referred to as daughter of Saul, meaning, "I don't ask you to bring her because I have missed her badly. because I love her so very much. No, because she's the daughter of Saul. And if I have her as my wife, everybody will realize that I'm the legitimate heir to the throne. So bring Michal, daughter of Saul, when you come before me. David also sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, who is now the king there, to say, give me, but here he refers to her as my wife, give me my wife Michal. But why does he mention that she is my wife? Because I have paid for this piece of merchandise. Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bride price of 100. And you see, we are talking about 100 and not about 200 foreskins. So Ish-bosheth, he realized that he cannot compete with David. David is the strong man, and now that Avner had joined him, that's it. So Ish-bosheth sent and her taken away from her husband, Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband walked with her as far as Bahurim, weeping. Oh, that's a real love story. It really touches my heart. You know, a man weeping for losing his wife, his beloved wife. And that shows you how big Michal's tragedy is. David did not love her. Then she was happily married to this other man. And now David takes her away from her husband because he wants to show that he is the strong man. Her husband walked with her as far as Bahurim, weeping as he followed her. Then Abner ordered him to turn back. And he went back. Very sad. Very sad. And now we get to chapter 6 of 2 Samuel. And chapter 6 is a very interesting, 2 Samuel chapter 6 is a very interesting story. Just a moment. Because this chapter is a crossroad. It's a crossroad in which two lanes actually meet. One lane is David the king, David the strong king, David who has conquered Jerusalem, David who's about to bring the ark to Jerusalem, David who does the right things. On the other hand, it's a story about David's family life, who is not that great. So we'll have a clash here between these two lanes. David, the successful king, and David, the not-so-successful husband. In order to understand what's going on in chapter 6, let me just remind you that in the book of Samuel, we follow the story of the ark. Almost from the very beginning of the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 3, when we meet young Samuel sleeping where the ark of God is. Then in the next chapter, chapter 4, the Israelites fight the Philistines in Aphek. They lose the battle, and the Israelites come up with a brilliant idea. Let's bring our secret weapon to the battlefield. And they bring the ark of God, and they are certain it's going to help. But of course, God has his own plans, and he lets his ark being taken captive. But don't you think even then God is weak or the ark is weak, because soon enough, the ark starts inflicting the Philistines with a series of inflictions very similar to the story of the 10 plagues in Egypt, actually. And the Philistines are shipping the ark from one city to another. Of course, it doesn't help, and they all get sick and die until they realize they have no choice but to send it back home. And when they send the ark back home, and of course, they add to it some silver and gold, again, remind you of the story of the Israelites in Egypt, of the slaves getting free. And the first stop of the ark when it gets back to Israel is in the city of Beth Shemesh. And at the beginning, the people of Beit Shemesh are very happy when they see the ark and everything is fine, and they sacrifice some sacrifice to the Lord, everything is fine. But all of a sudden, 70,000 people die because they have looked, they have seen the ark. One should not even look at the ark. The ark is holy. It's dangerous. You don't look at the face of God, and you don't look at the ark. That is actually the message. So the people of Beit Shemesh, like the Philistines, they don't want the ark there anymore, and they ship it over to Kiryat Yearim, Baalat or Kiryat Yearim, and that's where we are going to see the ark now. So this is 2 Samuel chapter 6. In the previous chapter, chapter 5, we are informed that David has conquered Jerusalem, called it Ir David, the city of David, and he makes actually Jerusalem his capital city. But one can wonder, why does David make Jerusalem his capital city? It's like making Brasilia the capital city of Brazil, city that has no history, nobody feels attached to Jerusalem. Of course, you can tell me that in the book of Genesis, well, you know, the story of the Akedah, if you want, or the short episode in Genesis 14, verses 18 to 20, about Melchizedek, king of Shalem. But actually, you see, it's Yevus. The city of Yevus is a Jebusite city. No history of ours there. And David conquers it, but he is very smart, making it into his capital city. Why do I say that he is smart? Because it's a neutral place. It's like Washington, D.C. Yeah, well, exactly. It's a neutral city. So the Judahites cannot blame him for making Shechem, for instance, which is an Ephraimite city, into his capital city. And the Ephraimites cannot blame him for choosing one of the Judahite cities to be his capital city. Because when he was king only over Judah, he had Hebron as his capital city. But now he realized it has to be a neutral place. But if you choose a neutral place that has no history to it, you pay a price, because people will not feel attached to it at all. So again, David has a brilliant idea of bringing the ark to Jerusalem, because the ark is the symbol of God's presence. The ark which goes with us from our happy days in the wilderness. So David wants this symbol, this ark, the presence of God in the city of David in Jerusalem. So the story goes like that. David again assembled all the picket men of Israel, 30,000 strong, 30,000 people. Think about the number. Those of you who still remember the parades of the Day of Independence in this country, remember what a great event it was, you know, so many people get together to see the parade, so the 30,000 people. Then David and all the troops that were with him set out from Baalim, that's the same as Kiryat Yearim, the same place, of Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God. See, look how the Ark is being referred to here. The Ark of God, to which the name was attached. The name Lord of Hosts enthroned on the cherubim. One should tremble even just reading the name of this Ark. It's actually the divine chariot. It's Air Force One. They loaded, but so it's not a piece of furniture. And you, David, decide to take it from one place to another without asking the boss? How dare you? And now he's going to pay the price. They loaded the Ark of God onto a new cart, of course, a new one, and conveyed it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Abinadab's sons, Uzzah and Ahio, guided the new cart. They conveyed it from Abinadab's house on the hill, Uzzah walking alongside the ark of God and Ahio walking in front of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel danced before the Lord to the sound of all kinds of cypress, wooden instruments. Okay, there are some interpretations being inserted into the verse. Okay. With lyres, harps, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. The Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra is playing music. It was a national great event. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nachon, Uzzah reached out for the Ark of God and grasped it, for the oxen had stumbled. Do you think it was just a coincidence that it happened? No way. God is pulling the strings up there. God wanted David to fail. God wanted to teach David a lesson. You don't move my ark without asking me my permission first, my dear. The Lord was incensed at Uzzah, of course, and Uzzah had to die. I told you 6 minutes ago what happened to the people of Beth Shemesh who just looked at the ark. Touching the ark is even more dangerous. It's like a high-voltage cable. You don't touch it. And since Uzzah touched it, poor guy had to die. He was well-meaning, but it doesn't change anything. You don't touch the ark. So God, the Lord was incensed at Uzzah, and God struck him down on the spot for his indiscretion, and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was distressed. God was angry with Uzzah. Now David is angry with God, actually. He invested so much in planning this national holiday, and now it's all gone. So David was distressed before because the Lord had inflicted a breach upon Uzzah. And that place was named Peretz Uzzah. The Bible will never miss a chance to explain a name, to make a nice name derivation, as it's still called. David was afraid of the Lord that day. He said, "How can I let the ark of the Lord come to me?" Now he realizes that the ark has a lot of power. But I think it's not just his being afraid, but it's also his anger, his frustration for what has happened. So David would not bring the Ark of the Lord to his place in the city of David. Instead, David diverted it to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Obed-Edom the Gittite from the city of Gath. And Gath is the city of Goliath. It's a Philistine city. It's like, I don't know if you ever watch soccer games, but David takes out the red card and shows it to the ark, and the ark has to leave the field and to go down to Gath. David punishes God, actually, by sending the ark away to Gath. But God has his own way to make David trying again. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom the Gittite, Obed-Edom and his whole household. And it was reported to King David, the Lord has blessed Obed-Edom's house and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. Thereupon, David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David. And here it's again what we call Moed Bet, second chance. But again, I have already told you, I think 3 weeks ago, all students who fail the first time fail the second time. Almost all of them. Because they don't get the message. David should have stopped and thought, why did I fail the first time? It was a mistake to bring the ark without discussing it first with God. And he's doing it again, but this time the failure would be of a very different nature. So David brings it amid rejoicing. When the bearers of the ark of the Lord had moved forward six paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. He's so relieved now. Here they walk. The oxen do not stumble. The ark does not fall. Everything is fine. Let's continue. David willed with all his might before the Lord. David was girt with a linen ephod. Very funny. Usually we are not being told in the Bible who's wearing what. I told you what an exception was the description of Goliath 2 weeks ago, that we had the full description of his armor and everything he was wearing, but that was very important. It was instrumental to the story. And is it instrumental to tell us what David is wearing, a linen ephod? Yes, it is. Those of you who remember the great cultural event of the Gashash HaChiver singing Maim LeDavid HaMelech, you remember that they were wearing mini skirts. And that was right. They did the right thing because this linen ephod is a very, very short linen piece of cloth. It will play a role in the story later on. Thus David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and with blasts of the horn. Now verse 16. As the ark of the Lord entered the city of David, Michal, pay attention, Michal, daughter of Saul, she does not feel anymore as the wife of David. She's so very frustrated. She was taken away from her loving husband. Now she feels like a prisoner in the royal palace. She hates David now. So Michal, daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and wheeling before the Lord, and she despised him for it. So Michal is at the window, which reminds us of the other window in 1 Samuel chapter 19. There she was, Michal, the wife of David, and she helped him and she loved him. But it's not the same anymore. Now she hates him, and now she is the daughter of King Saul, and she is despising David. David does not know it yet. He is still celebrating down there. We know it, we have been told, but he does not know it yet. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it up in its place, inside the tent which David has pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and offerings of well-being before the Lord. When David finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and the offerings of well-being, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. It was God who blessed the house of Edom, Obed-Edom the Gittite. Now it's David who blesses the people of Israel, and he distributed among all the people, the entire multitude of Israel, men and women alike, to each a loaf of bread, a cake made in a pan, pancake, and a raisin cake. Raisin cake, okay, fine. I'm so happy with the translation. Yeah. Then all the people left for their homes. That's it. The party's over. Now poor David has to go home, and he does not know what to expect there. David went home to bless again. The same term is being used in the Hebrew, to bless, levarech et beito, to bless his household. So again, I mention it, that it was God who had the power to bless the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Does David have the power to bless his own house or not? And Michal, daughter of Saul, bad news. Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet David. You know, whenever great heroes are coming back from war, the way when David came back from killing the Philistine, all women came out to greet him, to sing for him. And he can expect here his wife is coming out now. Perhaps she'll, you know, praise him for what he has done. But she came to meet David and said, "Didn't the king of Israel do himself honor today?" She's so very sarcastic, exposing himself, wearing the miniskirt. Now you understand why it was mentioned earlier. Exposing himself, he actually, when he danced, wearing these miniskirts, he exposed his organs. Exposing himself today in the sight of all the slave girls of his subjects as one of the riffraff might expose himself. On the one hand, we understand her anger, her frustration. But on the other hand, we don't necessarily agree with what she says. Whom does she think she is? All of a sudden, she is this queen, you know, standing up there in the window, looking down at the people. "We remember your father when he was still a farmer. Don't take yourself so seriously. You don't have blue blood." Yeah. So on the one hand, we agree with her. On the other hand, we are not so happy with what she says. David answered Michal, and he is also very cruel now when he answers her, because she has destroyed his big day. David answered Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father." Yeah, you are Michal, the daughter of King Saul, so I have news for you. God chose me to replace your father instead of your father and all his family, and appointed me the ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I'll dance before the Lord and dishonor myself even more, and below in my own esteem. But among the slave girls that you speak of, I'll be honored. And the end of the story is tragic, of course. So to her dying day, Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children. So both of them are losers. And this great event of bringing the Ark to Jerusalem ends the way it ends, tragically. Now I just quote here one verse from chapter 7, the following chapter. And the following chapter is the well-known story about Nathan and David, when David actually expresses his wish to build a temple for the Lord, a house for the Lord in Jerusalem. And then Nathan learns from the Lord that it's not the time yet to build a temple, that only Solomon will build a temple. But God is actually compensating David by telling him that God is building him a house, meaning that David will now become the father of a royal line and his sons will rule over Israel forever and ever. And after David hears the good news, in the verse I quote here, "Be pleased, therefore," says David to God, "be pleased, therefore, to bless your servant's house, that it abide for you forever. For you, O Lord God, has spoken. May your servant's house be blessed forever by your blessing." So now, finally, David did learn the lesson. He's humble again. He understands that he does not have the power to bless his own house, that only God has the power to do it. And he's actually asking God to bless his house. Now we get to another story, and this next story now is from 2 Samuel chapter 21. 2 Samuel chapter 21 is in the appendix. You remember that we have already discussed the appendix, the last four chapters of the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel chapters 21 to 24. You don't remember, I'll remind you. The tradition, okay. The tradition about Elchanan killing Goliath flows from this appendix. Meaning, in this appendix, we have traditions that didn't make it into the major line of the Book of Samuel. And all these traditions are preserved for us in the appendix. And the appendix breaks the natural continuity between 2 Samuel chapter 20, the end of Absalom's and Sheva ben Bichri's revolt against David, and the story about now David is about to die, what we have already mentioned from 1 Samuel chapter 1. Meaning, the story that we are following already from the story of David and Bathsheba is the story of the succession to David's throne. Meaning, first it's Amnon, who is the natural candidate to take his father's throne, and he is murdered by his brother Absalom. Then it's Absalom, who does what he does, rebels against his father, and then we get to the very beginning of the Book of Kings, and it's Adonijah who does exactly what Absalom has done, and then it's time for Solomon to take over. So it's very clear that chapters 21 to 24 in the second book of Samuel are just an appendix that the redactor of the Book of Samuel had to find a place for it. So he put it there. And in this appendix, we have a different, actually six different units. Two of them are narratives. One is 1 Samuel chapter 21. The last one is 2 Samuel chapter 24, the story of the threshing floor of Aravna, and of course the plague that took place from Dan to Beersheba. 70,000 people died, and then when the angel is about to hit Jerusalem, God stops him, and David builds the altar in Jerusalem, preparing us. Actually, it's a promo for the Book of Kings. This is the place of the temple to be. In between these two stories, chapter 21 and chapter 24, we have two lists of anecdotes about the acts of David's heroes. And in the very middle, we have two poems. One of them is actually 2 Samuel chapter 22, which is almost identical with the book of Psalms, Psalm 18. And 2 Samuel chapter 23, from verse 1 to verse 7, I believe, is the poem which is being called The Last Words of David, Divrei David Ha'acharonim. So in this appendix, it's an appendix, but yet it's very well organized, and there is a very nice relationship between like the first story and the last story. The first story in chapter 21 tells you about a famine that was in the land. For 3 years there was a famine in the land, and poor David did not know what to do, how to stop it. And then he realized that the Gibeonites were mistreated by Saul. They were... It's nice, listening to some music. Why not? Okay, anyway. So the Gibeonites were betrayed by King Saul. You know that Joshua, going back to the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 9, signed a treaty with the Gibeonites. They have cheated us, but yet Joshua, who was not smart enough to ask God whether it was a legitimate thing to sign the peace treaty with the Gibeonites, signed the peace treaty, and then he had to do it, and he could not kill them anymore. But now King Saul, we are being told in the appendix in 1 Samuel chapter 21, we hear that King Saul killed many of them. And that was the reason for the famine. And what is the demand of the Gibeonites in order to put end to the famine? That 7 descendants of King Saul will be given to them, will die. And poor David has no choice but to let it happen. Well, those of us who are cynical may say that it was not the most difficult decision for David. Because if you think about the history of the family of King Saul, how they slowly disappear miraculously. First, of course, it was Saul himself and his 3 sons who died on Mount Gilboa fighting the Philistines. And then it was Abner, son of Ner, the general, who was killed by Joab. And poor David lamented Abner, and it became known to the whole nation that David was not behind it. It's being said overtly. The whole nation knew that David had nothing to do with it. And when you are being told that the whole nation knew that David had nothing to do with it, I don't have to end the sentence. And then another one. And then it's Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. 2 people disguise themselves as merchants who come to buy some wheat from him. And when they enter his house, they kill him and bring his head to David. They expect getting a prize from David, but David, of course, killed them. So nobody knows who was behind it anymore. So when you read this story about David and killing these 7 descendants of King Saul, you can, if you want, you can be suspicious. Join me. Anyway, and if I say that there is a relationship between the story in chapter 21 and the story in chapter 24, what do I mean? Because in chapter 24, David insists on counting the people of Israel, something that should not be done. You don't count people. But he insists on doing it, and Joab warns him, don't do it, but he insists. He's very stubborn, and he counts them. And then one of the prophets, God, comes up with a word from God. You have to choose 1 of 3 punishments. Either we want 7 years of famine, by the way, in the Septuagint, and in the other version of the story in the Book of Chronicles, it's 3 years of famine, or 3 days that, or 3 months that you have to escape your own enemies, or 3 days, 3 years, 3 months, 3 days of a plague. And David gives a very diplomatic answer. Well, let's fall in the hands of God, whose mercies is well known. Meaning, I don't want to flee from my own enemies. And he doesn't care, actually, about the people of Israel suffering. He let God choose between 3 years of famine and 3 days of a plague. God chose the plague. But yet David was ready to let the people suffer from 3 years of famine. So it tells you, well, if in chapter 21 we were told that he wanted to put an end to this famine, he was not that sincere about it. That's the way you see the relationship between these 2 stories. Anyway, why do I tell you this story? It has nothing to do with Michal. Michal is the topic tonight. But if you look at this chapter now, about this small paragraph that I quote here, the king spared Mephibosheth. Well, there was 1 more descendant of King Saul that David decided to spare. The king spared Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, because of the oath before the Lord between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. You remember, perhaps, that Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan was could not have become a king because he was crippled. So again, if you want to be cynical, be my guest. Yeah, David could show his how nice he was by saving the life of Mephibosheth because of the oath he had with Jonathan, etc. Instead, the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the two sons, that Rizpah, daughter of Ayah, bore to Saul, and the five sons of whom? Look at the Hebrew text. Michal. So what do you think about these translators? How dare them to change the Holy Bible? You should never trust any translator. So we are talking here about the five sons that Michal, daughter of Saul, bore to Adriel, son of Barzillai, the Mecholatai. But of course, you know that Adriel, son of the Mecholatai, was the husband of Merav. But who knows? Who knows? Because we have already seen that Goliath was killed by Elkanah. There are different traditions. So here you have a remnant of a different tradition that actually Michal was the one that was given to Adriel the Mecholatite and not Merav. But of course, our translators did not want you to have any contradictions in the Hebrew Bible, so they changed the text. And he handed them over to the Gibeonites. They impaled them on the mountain before the Lord. All seven of them perished at the same time. They were put to death in the first days of the harvest, the beginning of the barley harvest. You know the story, very nice, like Antigone. Those of you who remember the play. Yeah, anyway, but our translators were not the first ones to face the difficulty here. And here I brought you the quotation from Sanhedrin. And the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel. Rabbi Joshua answers, was it then Michal who bore them? Because in the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 6, she had no sons. Surely it was rather Merav who bore them. But Merav bore and Michal brought them up. Therefore, they were called by her name. That's the a very midrashic way of solving a contradiction. And by the way, if you look at the Aramaic translation, Targum Jonathan to the Nevi'im, you'll see that this tradition from Sanhedrin has been embedded into Targum Jonathan too. Anyway, so what we saw today, a story of a tragedy, marriage, which is a tragedy between a princess who loved the young hero and an ambitious young guy who did not love his wife but wanted to be the son-in-law of the king. And into this tragedy, we saw some other traditions embedded into it about Merav. That's it for tonight. I hope to see you next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.